you like conversation on a variety of topics? Feel like no one wants to talk about the things that interest you? Tired of only hearing the same political, sports, or catastrophe talk? Yeah, we feel that way too. Join two high-functioning geeks as they discuss just about anything under the sun. We can't tell you what we'll be talking about each week because we don't know where our brains will take us. It will be an interesting conversation, though, so hang on and join us. Here comes the Relentless Geekery.
There we go. You're getting better and better backgrounds. I'm kind of boring with my consistent background here, but I did wear orange today, so I...
Yeah.
Okay.
I purposefully did a background search for Zoom backgrounds.
You know, I thank you. That's a great idea. I will have to, especially like, I don't know, I do that for my desktop. You know, I'll go like when it's Christmas, I'll go find Christmas things, or there's fall colors, or when I'm getting ready to go on a vacation, I find all kinds of, you know, paths into the woods and stuff like that. So
right. I do it on my phone, but then it annoys me and I take it off.
I've discovered, I used to change that with some regularity, and now I have like, I don't know, a constant background because only certain things only look good with icons. You know what I mean? Otherwise it gets very right. Busy and weird looking. And then for my home screen, well, I guess I have like, I don't know. I'm just not inspired to change it that often anymore. Maybe I'm just getting set in my ways, or you start to think of your phone as a certain thing. And right. I don't know. It's kind of funny because I really do like variety, and that's one way in which I don't evidence it. I'm surprised that I've stopped doing that because it used to be I'd go, hey, let's find the cool op art pattern. Let's find, out of all my interests, you know what I mean? It's like, let's find a wonder of the world and have the pyramids as a background or whatever else it might be. I hardly ever put either my or Colleen's pictures on there. That just seems something like egotistical, or we see each other every day or something. You know what I mean?
But, yeah. Yeah. Well, I since 95, Windows 95, mm-hmm. they had this Star Wars screensaver where the Jawas would come out and like pick apart pieces of your screen. And it would show like machinery underneath. So it was very clever and I loved it.
Yeah.
So nothing's been as exciting to me. So that's probably my thing.
In fact, I used to Pythonize my machine. You know, Monty Python put out a whole bunch of stuff like that where they had sounds attached to various different things. You could attach anything to, so, you know, when you'd eject a disc, it would give you a little like sound or something like that. And they were funny, but then after you've heard something the 10,000th time,
right,
it's just not as funny. So,
I was going to say back in the 90s, I got a new computer and it came with a Twilight Zone screensaver and stuff. And I forgot all about it. Brand new computer, set it up, whatever. Well, middle of the night, the sound was turned all the way up, and suddenly the Twilight Zone was doo, 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 and my wife at the time sits up screaming.
Right,
and
freaking out. Exactly. You know, it's kind of funny. I've never used ringtones. That's another thing, is that I tend, mm-hmm. I have a Spaces type sound so that it's distinct from everybody else's phone. I use one that's relatively uncommon, so I kind of know it's my phone, but I never really attach one for particular people. And that's another thing that I didn't want to have to process. Not only am I getting a call, but who is it? Somehow it's just, maybe I'm more visual than audio, you know, stimulated, right. And that it, I didn't need to know. I don't know. And it's also, I didn't want to have people get some insight into what do I think of them.
Like the Looney Tunes theme.
The Looney Tunes theme, or the, your Wicked Witch of the West for your ex-wife, right. Or whatever else it might be. And that, I don't know. That just seems like it was like I didn't want to put a lot of time into it. And when I saw
there was
expense associated with it, that it wasn't the world of free ringtones, that it was, in order to get a good sounding one, you had to pay like $3, $5. I'm like, am I really going to get nickel and dime to have 50 different ringtones for my various different friends or activities? And I'm going to put another $250 into my phone?
Right.
It seems like an odd conceit.
Plus, I think it's slightly human nature and probably the nerd human nature. I mean, we grew up with the rotary phone. So if the phone rang, you had to run across the house to get it. And by the time we got cell phones, well, you know, we were a little older. So it's not as novel, and we don't care as much. And like you said, you got to go through every single contact and get a new ringtone, and then you get a new phone next year and they all go away.
And that's true. Yeah, so. I never had that if they were portable or not, but, and actually this where one of the things that I remember reading that I thought was actually fascinating was that there really are people that make a living doing that, that they have right. a really good ear for what sounds interesting, characteristic, funny, whatever in that 3 second, that 1 second blip. And so that they really were great at picking sounds out of the environment or picking snippets of songs. And especially then you have to be careful about, you're not allowed to steal it. It has to be so short that it's reminiscent of, but not right. actually using. And, you know, right. there's all those kinds of rules. Have you heard this one too? You know, Robert Fripp, who a guitarist that I really like from King Crimson, and they've done well as a group and so forth. But from what I understand, the reason that he is now independently wealthy, or at least well off, is he wrote the opening noise for Windows 95. Like, that's his.
Oh, really?
And so, you know what I mean? It's one of those things where, hey, he got a penny a play. And then if you have that played 100 billion times, you're right. going to do just fine, you know? And also that some, there's all kinds of sampling going on in the world of music. And there's all kinds of, you would think sometimes it doesn't cross genres, but for instance, he had a part of a song, and I wish I could be more authoritative, but like Kanye West borrowed for a song, but they really do pay royalties if it's recognizably so. And so I think it's from either 21st Century Schizoid Man or Starless or something of his that's really like heavy and crunchy, but all you got to do is have a skillion selling artist appropriate something of yours, and then you right. get a little, again, a little salami slice of his earnings. And right. I think that's kind of cool that you make something so memorable that, like, there's a famous, you know, scream that every yeah. monster movie uses. And, you right. know, that's whoever did that, I hope that they get royalties. Sometimes it really was, they find out those people labored in obscurity. They were the Foley artist, and the particular sound of feet walking across gravel that everybody in the world uses. No, the guy who created that didn't really get anything for it.
Right. You know, so. George Romero didn't get much for his Night of the Living Dead because he didn't copyright it.
There you go. Like that, you know, so
it's funny. Oh dang. Now my mind went blank. So that's something this is my way of thinking, I guess. You know, there have been through the years many lawsuits because people took somebody else's music and used it and then didn't give them credit and didn't admit, you know, Vanilla Ice is very,
right.
it comes to mind. Oh no, mine's totally different. Right. Whatever. And that the Ghostbusters theme with "Want a New Drug" by Huey Lewis.
Right.
My thinking is, why don't you make sure everybody knows where you got it? Why don't you make sure and make it so everybody wins in that? Because when Ghostbusters came out, it was huge and Huey Lewis was huge. We'll do it together. Man, I'd go see Ray Parker with Huey Lewis doing that song or showing up on interviews or just, it exactly. seems like everybody could win rather than, hey, let's try and get this without paying a couple bucks.
That's true. People have a different attitude about that, about, you know, Metallica was very famous for, you know, no, don't sample, don't steal our music, especially in the era of Napster and the first file sharing services. They were very much, you know, don't steal from us. Whereas others were like, if that gets me publicity and gets more people to come to my tours because they want to hear the original right. artist that did it or whatever. And some people actually embrace it. If you remember when one of the first real obvious appropriations was when Run DMC redid Walk This Way
right.
as a rap version. And then Steven Tyler appears in the video. You know what I mean? That yeah. And does his scream and stuff like that. So it's kind of cool to have that little handoff almost.
Yeah. They say that song rejuvenated Aerosmith, that Aerosmith may have just gone away. So there you go. Everybody won. Run DMC got a little more exposure with a mm-hmm. classic rock group. It brought Aerosmith back. You know, that's a perfect example. Everybody exactly. won from that.
Yeah. In fact, as you know, in the tech world, they had to make the big mind transition from scarcity to abundance. By that meaning, you know, this thing called the network effect, that the value of everything on the network goes up the more that people use it, not the less. Yeah. You don't have scarcity driving the price of things, like advice I'm well aware of with Comic Bookville that I keep talking about, but that as you have more people adopt a platform like Facebook, a platform like Zencastr, where they they use it, they talk about it. It becomes kind of the lingua franca for how does an app like that work? What are the key presses and that kind of thing? And so I thought that Microsoft, for instance, early on kept shooting itself in the foot where they would say, the way that we've got this set up is ours and only ours. And if you're going to write another, you know, word processor, another spreadsheet program, you have to use a whole different set of key presses. Whereas Apple said, we're going to make kind of like user interface guidelines, and it's always going to be Z is, you know, Z, X, C, V, the various different things that they standardized, that it became everyone trusted Apple when they saw that the choices that they made were actually quite instinctual, and that doing it another way actually kind of disrupts instead of being the natural flow of how you work. So Microsoft eventually did get with the program. I think that they actually had a lawsuit between like Lotus 1-2-3 and Excel, if I remember right, as to which one looked too much like the other or worked too much like the other. And I don't know, there's rules about, it's not only a matter of network effect, it's also a matter of just total theft and appropriation. You know what I mean? You can't rewrite something and call it your own when obviously there is a work of art. The first occurrence of something, when somebody gave it a try, it might not have the force of total popularity and familiarity behind it yet. And so when you just do it to kind of piggyback on somebody else's, well, that's how the, you know, the courts have to decide all these things. They have to say, how much are you really trying to imitate them and therefore being confused for them? And that's when you get in trouble for copyright and trademark violations. It's not that you're like them. It's when you're so much like them that you could be mistaken for them, and therefore you're cutting into their income. You know what I mean? So,
and the problem then also, it gets expanded in that people sue for things that are like, no, come on, that is nothing like yours, and that's totally different. Or, you know, it's not, they want to sue because they had the idea, not the implementation of the idea. Well, you know, ideas are a dime a dozen.
That's right. In fact, that's the boy. There's a great book called Code, probably like 30 years old now, by a guy named Lawrence Lessig. And he talked a lot about, when we're getting into this era of digitization and it's easy to make copies and it's easy to code things that are like lookalikes and act-alikes and stuff like that, it isn't that you had that great idea, like you said. It's the implementation of that, the creation of that. And then they had to do a whole bunch of case law that says, well, now implementation is not, here's a physical car, and that you copyright the fin, or they started to have, well, can you copyright the growl of a Harley Davidson? What are the characteristics of something? And especially about code, that it was so easy to make duplicates or to make act-alikes that they had to get finer and finer in. Now it's not a matter of what does that chair look like and how does it, if you will, work. It's a matter of, there's a whole bunch of stuff that goes into, does it feel the same? Does a user sit down and are they immediately familiar, or are they lost a little bit? I don't know. His book is great because it really goes into that code is kind of the new copyright law, that it isn't only a matter of does the law protect you, it's does your ability to create something brilliant but quickly kind of protect you, because while someone else is trying to duplicate what you've got, you've already moved on to version 2 and version 3 and version 4.
Right.
And by always staying ahead of the game, you kind of build in your own non-obsolescence and market dominance, you know?
Right. So, and, you know, you talk about look-alike and the generalization. I remember back, whatever it was, 20 years ago, AT&T got a copyright on using the left side for navigation menus on websites. And then they tried to sue everybody in the world. But at the time, you know, for reference, at the time, every single website was built with navigation on the left-hand side.
Exactly. It honestly, what you said earlier about frivolous lawsuits, we've seen those kinds of things. Windows tries to like trademark the word window. And like, honestly, come on. I know, you know, it's when you see that the lawyers are how you have a competitive advantage instead of the quality of your technology or the quality of the infrastructure that you've created, the ecosystem that surrounds your applications, you know that they've decided that we're not going to fight this on the basis of brilliance or technology. We're going to fight on the basis of nits and grits of law. And that just seems, for a technology company, to be a huge false step, a huge concession to, we're not the best thing out there, but we're the craftiest. We're the slyest, most cunning, most relentlessly legalistic about it. And it, for tech people, that leaves a real bad stink when it's the suits that are deciding things in a courtroom instead of like The internet has always been run on, you don't have endless meetings to find out the perfect way to do it. And then you try things. And whenever the most people adopt, because it is the easiest, best, most cunning way to do things, there's this kind of overall, over the course of time, you get to high quality because of adoption. You know, and so when you first started to have that bumping into that, it's not even a matter of particular applications, but entire OSs like Linux. You know, first Unix came out and it was always in the public domain, or at least various different variations of it were much more kind of academic than commercial. And then when they started to have versions of Linux or Unix available from Red Hat and various other places, and the distros might have different characteristics, but they didn't fight the fight of Microsoft saying, once you go with our OS, you're locked into a certain browser. You're locked into, you know, it's kind of that whole, I don't know, open source or open and closed garden. This is actually kind of funny. We didn't know what we were going to talk about today, but there's so much that has gone into this. And interestingly, nowadays, the world has kind of decided some of these issues. So people nowadays, when they come on, they don't need to worry about it. But way back, let's say 25 to 30 years ago, when they first started to put like V chips in VCRs that actually prevented things from running based on what machine it was, what country code it had, it really was an incredible intrusion compared to this tape will work in anything that is a VCR or anything that's a Betamax, you know, VHS, I should say, versus Betamax. And then when you started to have people trying to create artificial barriers to use and like, hey, I own this tape, it shouldn't be that you have anything to say about what machine, or that if you're going to do something like that, make it worth my while, make it so you have such a rich feature set that I don't mind being locked into your ecosystem because it's better. But when you're crappy and you're still exclusive, it's a really, I know it really leaves a really bad stink in the public's mouth. You know what I mean? So taste.
And, you know, we've talked a little bit about some of that with like, especially digital. And, you know, if you can stream it in one country, you can stream it in another, but then you have all these other copyright laws and things like that. But coming from the author side, I see some of that as I understand, because there are so many authors that put out a book and they have an agent, they have a publishing company, and then that publishing company says, okay, you can't write book two because book one didn't sell enough, and now you're screwed. Or
they own characters. They own whatever you thought you were the creator of. Right.
Right. Yeah. Or they say, hey, your book's super popular in America. We're going to go put it over in Germany. And since you gave us all rights, you don't get any money for that. We're going to translate it and put it in German. Oh, and now we're going to put it in Finnish. And now it's going over to France. And, oh, hey, this is really popular. Now we're going to make a movie out of it and you don't get any money. And now we're going to make a movie over in Japan. Totally different about it. And guess what? We're selling figures. So unfortunately, we've got all these laws, but that's then the bad side where people are like, well, I want to copyright the left side nav because I can, and I want to copyright this, and I want to sue for this because you use the same color orange on the Pantone scale that I used.
Right. I'll tell you, that's some way in which a lot of people, like you said, especially artists, have had to become very canny because, you know, they use that, bad people will use that against you. If you're not aware of, hey, I signed a contract and they're going to take care of me. And then you find out, oh, that didn't include the CD rights, the repro rights, the foreign rights. I just read this recently in, I think, either Proc Magazine or Classic Rock or something like that, that Steve Vai, a fantastic guitarist, has never made it big in the mainstream. He doesn't have a lot of radio airplay and so forth, but he's doing good. And the way that he explains that was Frank Zappa, he played with Frank Zappa for a while. Any number of great, as you know, artists have come up through the Zappa camp, you know, him and Adrian Bowie. And Zappa's most telling advice that he gave him was retain your publishing rights.
Yeah.
That instead of just, you know, counting on your company and whatever company they might sell out to and they might sell out to and all that kind of stuff, that learn to be your own best reader of your contract, your own best extrapolator of what might happen into the future, and make sure that it's spelled out. Hey, if this ever gets included as in a Christmas compilation for whatever reason, that right. it's not yours to do that. It's mine. And it really might not even be necessarily right of refusal and stuff like that, but it definitely is that you will get some share, some residual from all that being done. And that he is comfortable because he made a point, instead of being a great guitarist, but a bad businessman, that he actually has been, just by devoting a little bit of time to minding the store, he makes sure that his stuff, some part of what he has created, always comes back to him. And that just seems fair somehow, doesn't it? That it's not, you do the one thing and then a whole bunch of other people pile on and say, well, now I got something to work with here. You know, that kind
of
thing.
Well, the self-publishing world is really, and part of this is COVID now, it's taking off. Because when you're on Amazon, you don't know what publisher it is unless you specifically look for it. So people see a good book, it's got good reviews. Heck, my wife was just giggling yesterday because she found a series of books that are very similar to The Outlander Show, written by totally somebody else, but it's the same type of idea. Alan, you there?
See, I'm on. Hi, I really did. I dropped out. So please, boy, this stinks. I'm really sorry, Stephen.
I
just restarted my router. I restarted my laptop for whatever reason. I don't know what latest update, either system software-wise or firmware-wise, has made it that my Wi-Fi is now undependable in the house. But I thought that I was still going because it looked like I still had a Wi-Fi connection, and then I didn't. So, oh boy, I need to figure out how to solve this because obviously we can't have this choppiness that you have to kind of piece back together. This is terrible.
Right. Well, you know, hey, tech happens. But it looks like we might have to do a second recording because I don't see your waveform.
Okay. So do you have to initiate? There. Yes. Now I'm seeing it.
There it goes.
Okay.
Wow.
Wow. Yeah. I just...
And it could be totally on their end too.
You know, there have been things where the weather, the net itself, there's and Zencaster Zoom. I know
Mars is in retrograde.
Really? People have already been talking about, you know, Zoom has just soared in popularity. And so some part of what people are doing is they're retreating to Skype or GoToMeeting or whatever because they're not having to deal with Zoom's servers themselves are
right.
The bottleneck and the problems thereof of being the most popular thing on the block. So,
right. So, okay. Well, picking up where we froze and left off, I was going to say, we were talking about the rights and owning the rights. One of the latest great case studies, and I think this really hammered it home to people. You've probably heard the name Brandon Sanderson.
Yes.
He's got great fantasy stories. He finished the Wheel of Time series when Jordan passed away.
Worked on Dune, same thing, right? Exactly. Okay.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So very big, popular author. People know him. So when he puts out a book, it sells. He's not hurting for money.
Right.
He's not worried about the next book selling. They just do.
Exactly. I like his stuff. I buy every one of his. Exactly. Okay.
So he, in his contract with his publishing company, he reserved the right to special edition hardbacks. Now, you know, that's not a huge market. That, you know, that's probably something if the publisher was involved in, they'd put a lot of money into it and not get a whole lot of money back. So they said, sure, fine, keep it. We don't need to worry about special edition hardbacks.
Right.
Brandon Sanderson was a smart man. He took a book that he wrote 25 years ago, one of his fantasy books. I don't remember which one offhand.
Maybe Elantris or something like that. Okay.
Yeah. I'd have to look. I don't remember.
Yeah.
And he said, I'm going to create a hardback special edition and I'm going to put it on Kickstarter. The only way to get this book is through Kickstarter to buy it directly from me. And there was whatever specialness about it. Maybe he added something. I don't quite know. But he not only did well, the end of the Kickstarter was $6.5 million. That's how many people got that book.
Wow.
That's and fantastic. I bet the publishers are kicking themselves.
You know, I have always admired where people have either the confidence or just the devil may care attitude that says, I don't want a percentage or of, you know, how well we all do. I will take on more risk to get more reward. Again, you know, doing my stock thing, that's very much what it's about. It doesn't necessarily be who's the, it matters that risk versus reward. And so there's all kinds of people in Hollywood, for instance, the John Wick movies, or even going all the way back to The Matrix, Keanu Reeves said, I don't want to care about how well the, all the expenses of the movie, if you will, but if this movie that we're not sure how well it's going to do does well, I'll put a whole bunch of money and my time up front, and I'll get more on the back end. And his bet has paid off very handsomely.
Big time.
So has Danny DeVito's. So has John Cusack. You know what I mean? There's a couple of them that have either, and either in the studio system itself, that they were able to drive a good contract by just saying, hey, it's all on me. I'm the name above the title. You know, give me more benefit in case this does well. But there's also others that just said, I don't want to play the studio game of who gets how many tiny little percentages niggling away at things. Yeah, we've talked about this a little bit before. Dolph Lundgren, John Cusack, they have great careers where they just say, I'm going to make a $5 million movie. It'll make $25 million. Repeat. You know what I mean?
Right.
That,
yeah.
And so I really love hearing about when someone does that kind of thing of, I'm going to just try something, and then it does handsomely. And like, well, good for you for having the smart idea. Good for you for taking on all the risk and a lot of times all the work. Louis C.K., nowadays, unfortunately, kind of in the doghouse, but he was one of the first guys that said, I'm going to tape one of my specials and I'm just going to say, put it on the net, $5. Instead of being, how long can I tour on the circuit and how can I deal with any of the Netflixes or HBO, I'll sell it direct. And after that first thing did enough money, he's like, I just bought a New York brownstone because a lot of people paid the $5. You know, right. You only need 20,000 people. Am I right about this? You know, 200,000 people to make $1 million. I don't want to drop a zero. Apparently he did. So it's kind of cool when that happens, that something blows up wonderfully unexpectedly in comic books, in movies, in comedy, whatever else it might be.
Well, there's, you know, the king of that, the grandfather that started most of that, George Lucas, you know, back in the day, he said, look, I'll take less money from the movie, but I want all the merchandising rights. And Fox at the time is like, well, heck, that's, you know, a couple dollars. Go ahead, keep it. Hello.
Exactly. I think closets full of Star Wars figures later. Exactly.
Why do we have all these collectibles now? Thank you, George Lucas, for being a billionaire.
That's very funny.
In fact, I
think that's maybe something that people have all become, we talked about this earlier, very cunning about, is it isn't only the main vehicle. You know, for a lot of boy in the era of COVID, so as soon as file sharing services happened, a lot of artists, musical artists, really kind of lost the ability to control their product. And so they said, well, we're going to have to do kind of the lost leader, the giveaway almost of our songs, and we'll make it up in touring because we're the only ones that can do that. You know, they can't represent themselves as Bare Naked Ladies without being Bare Naked Ladies.
Right.
Well, COVID happens, and for like 9 months now, people have not been able to be on tour. And so I've done all kinds of different things where I like watch something online and then I like give money to the artist, the roadies, when they were part of the Goodman Theater presentation of Death of a Salesman that I just spoke of, was please give money to the Actors Fund for all those people that are out of work while all the theaters are dark. They got to live. They got to have something to eat. And so I think that becoming more and more cunning about what are your sources of income and then thinking of, where do you get your most advantage in spending all your time on that? You know what I mean? And not all your time, but at least not just giving it away to somebody else. You know, I have a good friend who wrote soap operas, has written soap operas and done continuity for soap operas for decades now. And she gets very nice residuals. And it's one of those things where you don't realize how much money is in that industry until she has a beautiful house on the lake. And she, you know what I mean? It's kind of cool to see that things that I didn't even have a feel for how much money is really involved in that industry. But then all you do is sit back for a moment and saying, well, that show has been on for 50 years. And that show is addictive to how many millions of housewives stay at home and whatever all the other things that roll out from that. The fact that it also has reruns or bundlings of various different things.
Well, streaming. You can go to CBS and watch Days of Our Lives from the past 40 years or something.
Exactly that. You know, so, and just that, when you the fact that I can name soap operas like Days of Our Lives, Young and the Restless, you know, that kind of stuff. And then you find out, well, that's been on since the 50s. You know, that's like a 70-year show. That's kind of an amazingly cool thing, actually. So,
Okay. So what else was on the topics of discussion?
Let's see. Well, about digitization, by that meaning, you know, and it's right in line with what we were just talking about, the more that things have become, you know, I'm kind of interesting. I have such a foot in multiple camps nowadays of I'm dealing in comic books and there really is known scarcity for these various different things. They really know that there's only this many copies that were published. And as they get graded by the various different grading services, you find out, you know, all those copies that moms and dads threw away because Billy needs to grow up and get out of comic books, you kind of get a feel for that really did happen to certain books, or they didn't survive the paper drives of the war. Right. Or whatever else it might be. So there's real physical scarcity, just like there is for coins or stamps or fine art, any of those kinds of collectibles. But on the other hand, there's things got digitized. So one of the things I've been doing lately is I have lots of music. And, you know, as that became that you can get it in various formats and can get it on CD or get it by streaming or whatever else it might be, I just have this fun little conceit of I think lately, because maybe I just wasn't aware of them, but I think it's become a big thing now. They have original album classics, little box sets that are like five albums from a certain artist. And it's usually like they have good taste. It's their best five. It's not the early rough ones. And it's not when they sold out and became totally commercial, but it's like when they were really commercially viable. And they're sold for like five CDs for $20. And I have a magic number in my mind of $7 that's what I'm usually willing to pay for a CD. And wow, these are all at $4. And so it's like, is there anything that I don't want for $4? Maybe I don't want Pablo Cruz, you know, things that I really hate. Maybe I don't want Vanilla Ice, but I like Montrose. I like Molly Hatchet. I like REO Speedwagon. Yeah, and I just have been glomming onto these things for $20. Like once a week, I throw a $20 out there and yeah, you know, back to me comes, let me just glance over. Let's see. Like I said, Spirit, the Doobie Brothers, Chicago.
Oh, Doobie Brothers.
And then what's funny is when you see, it's not only that I really like some of those songs, some of the albums are wonderfully dense. The Doobie Brothers don't have one hit per album like some others do. They have like four great songs per album.
Yeah.
So I didn't quite buy the greatest hits. I wanted to have the context of who were they at the time? Who were the artists that were on the album? What kind of music were they making? Because the Doobie Brothers have changed kind of over the course of time. But right. You go back and you hear, man, China Grove still sounds great. You know what I mean? And
I introduced Frankie, my oldest stepson. I introduced him to the Doobie Brothers. Mm-hmm. We were at a actual recital for Megan, and someone did a Doobie Brothers song. And Frankie said, "Hey, that was pretty good." I'm like, "You've never heard Doobie Brothers?" "I don't think so." So he sat in the car with me and we went home listening to the greatest hits.
Okay.
You know, so of course everything is like bam, bam, bam. He's like, "Oh my God, this is so good."
Yeah. And sometimes people don't know how many great songs they have. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's like I got to Guess Who. And that's another, like they have a particular album that has, you know, American Woman and you know, and just like that, there's the whole, probably the first four cuts on the album are like hit after hit after hit. They're one, exactly. For the Doobie Brothers, I must admit, there's two different collections, and one of them is the early era, and then one of them is like the Michael McDonald era. And I really don't, I think they softened. I don't care for them as much. They became a little bit too much album oriented, rock, radio friendly, instead of being
music,
southern crunch, you know what I mean? And I usually don't do that. Usually if I'm going to get something, I like to have one to end of anything because I'm such a collector. But for this particular thing, I don't know that I need to go too early into the Journey catalog. And actually, I take that back. Journey I really like because they were kind of proggy before they went more commercial, but I like both of their periods. Whereas for the Doobie Brothers, I think I'm going to stay away from the Michael McDonald things. I thought they just kind of got wimpy or something.
It's the old Van Halen argument, you know,
right,
with David Lee Roth or with Sammy Hagar.
Right, different. Exactly.
You know, not the only ones that have done that.
Yeah. And it's also, the reason I thought it was an interesting topic was, a long time ago, I read a book called The Long Tail by Chris, can't think of it, but he was like the lead editor for Wired Magazine. I can't believe I can't remember his name because he's very, Chris Kelly, I think. And what it talked about was, we're really in this wonderful time of, because of digitization and because of Amazon and various different things, that it used to be, something came out and it did all of its sales like in its first year, and it had to be a big hit in order to make a lot of money, or it just kind of like got relegated to not quite the cutout racks, but it didn't stay in stores because there's only so much physical space to put albums in a store. And as a group built its repertoire over the course of time, you could see which ones had like seven different albums represented and which had just one or two, their two best. Well, digitization changed all that. You had an infinite amount of room in your warehouse. You had the ability to have something that came out 20 years ago. If it keeps selling, we're going to keep offering it. So it didn't kind of get faded. You know, even bookstores and CD stores, record stores back when they were LPs, they used to kind of do that regular inventory cleanup of, wow, this hasn't moved in a long time. The odds of it moving anytime soon are poor. Us keeping a single copy of this around, there were some stores that specialized in having deeper bins, if you will. But most of them, they, in order to stay in business, they had to stay with the stuff that if your top 100 albums are selling 80% of your sales, you kind of have to be aware of where that tail gets shorter as it goes. Well, the long tail, man, you could have things that were just selling 10 albums a year, 10 copies a year, you could still keep in the bins, if you will. And if you were a collector like me who loves getting, if I'm going to listen to Hawkwind, I don't want just the two or three ones that everybody knows. I really want all 30 of their albums. And it used to be you just couldn't find them. If you had to go to those particular record stores that had that and scour the bins, and when they started to come out with reissues on CDs, that was cool because then you could finally get them again if you couldn't get them on vinyl. And oftentimes when they did CDs, they also included B-sides and rare tracks. And so she actually got like a little bit of bonus for doing it. But just the fact that the long tail said something doesn't have to sell a ton in order to still be viable. And then what started to happen, it wasn't just back catalog. A whole bunch of companies got in the cool business of, you know, this artist had its heyday 10, 15, 20 years ago. They're still making music. It just doesn't get a lot of radio airplay, but you know what? Their fans seek it out. And so Kansas can continue to make music and tour and put out albums without having to be the radio monsters that they were back in the 80s. And name the number of groups. There were certain labels that actually specialized in that, you know, that the guy kind of had this
Rhino Records.
Exactly. K-Tel. Yes. And K-Tel a little bit different because it really seemed to be
greatest hits
and like almost like, anyway, I love the fact that, the producers that had a real good feel for what is still viable, that bands that would have just, well, our career is done. We're going to have to become stockbrokers and roofers and stuff like that. But instead, they really got a chance to like, and whatever that little circuit was, if we're not selling out stadiums anymore, but you know what? If we go out just during the summer and hit all of the summer fests and stuff like that, and not even as a nostalgia act only, they still sounded great. They were still incredibly talented musicians. So I loved seeing the extension of, wow, I can still hear Jean-Luc Ponty. I can still Kansas. You know what I mean? Things that some that never really made it that big, but others that they had their heyday and then they kind of faded. So,
one of the things I think independent publishing has embraced and does that I hope triggers a little more into the music world. And I know the music world got sidetracked because of all the Napster and the MP3s and that stuff. But indie publishing, okay, so we mentioned Brandon Sanderson. You know that name.
Right.
Do you know the name Lindsay Baroker?
No, I don't.
No, she's an author. She writes fantasy. She writes some steampunk. She writes some sci-fi, a mixture of that. She's a very prolific author.
Okay.
She's independent. You've never heard of her, but she makes over $1 million a year selling fiction books.
Fantastic.
And that's what the, you know, independent publishing can do. Obviously, it's not a, you know, oh, hey, I published a book, I'm a millionaire. But she doesn't need to have a million records sold or, you know, books on this newest book. She has a whole collection of books and people go and buy the old ones. They, you know, and she just keeps writing at her pace. I hope the music industry can capture that a little more. Like you said, that these people can produce albums, produce music and put them out that we can get and it's new, but we don't have to go to the record stores, which don't exist, that we don't have to necessarily only hear it on Spotify. Cause I agree. And I understand if a new album comes out from someone I like, I want to buy the physical copy because I don't want to rely on Spotify. I don't want to have to, you know, try and find it somewhere. And then I've always got it.
We really do both have that quirk or that prejudice is I really do want to have the physical thing so that they can't take it away from me. And in fact, one of my pet peeves is, maybe you've had this happen, you know, I regularly digitize my stuff, and I, for instance, I use iTunes. Well, you put a CD in and you have 10 cuts on the album, and then somehow one of them is missing after it's been digitized, because there's a rights battle over it, because whatever might be going on, but Apple doesn't include it, and it actually won't even let you keep it within iTunes because of having to avoid. And like, but I have that song, so I have to actually revert to going into my stereo, which has a CD player, to listen to the entire.
Let me argue that, because yes, iTunes, Amazon had that too. And for a while, I did that with Amazon, and you would put the disc in and it would read it, and then it'd find it in its collection and add it to your cloud library.
Right.
So I was doing that with all my stuff. Well, then I found out the same problem you had, that's not really ripping it. It's, you know, and I'm like, okay, screw that. So all my CDs I've ripped, I have the physical MP3 on my hard drive, and I manage it through directories. I don't even have anything else. I just have all my directories on the hard drive.
See, and so, what I want is, there has to be something besides iTunes out there that would enable me to do a lot of creating playlists and being able to like get album art and all the other things without having the Big Brother aspect of, we're not going to allow you to listen to that song because our copy can't include that song. You know,
you ever tried a Winamp?
Long time ago, when I was doing more on Windows than on Macintosh. So
they have plugins, and they also do library and direct. They sort through your directory and look at the meta tags and all that. Okay. I have used Winamp, but I don't use it consistently enough that I feel comfortable just relying on it. So I don't have a good solution other than that, really, myself.
One of these, I'll have to do a little, you know, search for, is there a great, like, not to be weird, Collectors, which I've been using now for my books and music and comic books, does have a music thing. And I've only used it to just keep track of what CDs I have, but I'm pretty sure that it has a player and perhaps some of those other library meta features that you're talking about. So it could be that I'm foolish. I already have the solution in hand and I just haven't exercised it. You know what I mean? So,
well, it's crazy, Al. I mean, it's too bad that the two of us don't know anybody that has written any code and could create something. You know, that's a difficult thing to, you know, we should find somebody like that.
You know, as I've laughed about, one of the reasons that I got really good at databases and all that kind of stuff was I had big collections early, and they quickly were beyond a spreadsheet. You know, I didn't just want things where I could sort on multiple columns. I wanted to be able to create the connections between, like, okay, I like Genesis, and that's Phil Collins and Michael Rutherford and Steve Hackett and Tony Banks. And wow, Phil Collins also plays on, like, he played with Philip Bailey, or he was in Brand X, and that's his jazz, you know, fusion jazz. And I wanted to be able to kind of, what I do in my mind and when I wander the shelves is the little connections. I kind of wanted to formalize it. And so I started to write databases that allowed me to do that. You know, I think I mentioned Fourth Dimension, a fantastic database package for the Mac, that's actually how I wrote Gambit, you know, my artificial intelligence trading thing. It had really powerful programming language behind it. And what I kept thinking was, well, this is really cool, but it's kind of only for me. I don't know how I'm ever going to make this into a product. And will anybody care about the features that I put in as much as I do? You know, they might care about, I don't know, what condition it is, not who played on who else's albums and those kinds of things. Right. So, oh, well.
Well, this is kind of connected to all this, a little separate, kind of a news item I heard about. We were talking about the artist getting the rights and things like that. So Spotify recently went into podcasting. So our podcast is actually on Spotify. People can get it and listen to it. Mm-hmm. And they do that. But they now have a new feature, which is only usable on Spotify. But what you can do... Okay, one of the issues, as we talked about, was the trademark and copyright, that we can't just throw Doobie Brothers music in here. We get in trouble. Right. You know, they deserve the money for it.
Right, we can. We have to pay. Exactly.
You know, yeah. I don't think we're earning enough money on the podcast to pay them yet. But, you know, if they're willing to come on and talk and sing live, hey, we're all for that.
That's right.
But so Spotify has a thing that if you create the podcast on Spotify, their platform, you can find music in the Spotify library, include it in your podcast, and it's just like people listening to the music. So you could put whole songs within your podcast and include it, and the artists get as much money as they would as if somebody went and listened to it.
That's interesting. So you're kind of the curator. You know what I mean? Yeah. You're actually putting together what you think is the interesting parts of. That's very interesting. It sure is the next step for, as long as Spotify has so much on there. And yeah, if, instead of having an algorithmic recommendation engine, because there's lots of those out there, Pandora and various others have had those for a long time, it's actually a human being, kind of like Stevie Van Zandt, you know, from the E Street Band, used to do with his underground garage. He has such an extensive record collection that you wanted to hear what was his cool discovery from 1957 that he still listens to. You know, I love people that have that kind of in-depth, but also quirky, you know, take on their taste. And it's just very cool to see, wow, I never would have learned about that, except he told me. Hats off to him.
And I love those type of radio shows.
Yeah.
And there we go, Alan. There's our side podcast. We should do, maybe we should do a limited run. We should find like 10 songs that have changed our lives or changed history or something like that, and go on the Spotify and create a podcast, just 10 episodes, and those 10 songs, we talk about that song in depth, some of the history of it, and
I'd
why we like it.
I'd be more than willing to give it a try. That'd be a very cool thing to investigate. Oh my God.
We've got our
great branching live, out.
we've got our great live podcast this weekend with all the horror stuff going on, and I'm excited about that.
I've already so many notes. I don't know how we're going to get through it all. Imagine. And I don't know how we're going to let anybody else talk.
I know.
You know what I mean?
It's going to be a chaos. But yeah, that, I think we should do that. And if we make it like a limited thing, we can, you know, that way it's not like, oh man, we got two podcasts now a week. You know, hey, we're just going to do these episodes, see what happens.
And yeah.
I'd love that, because we're so into music, and I love, there's so much good music out there. And like Frankie with the Doobie Brothers, you know, he's 25. He'd never knew who the Doobie Brothers, I'm sure he's heard something, but if you don't know the artist, you don't remember it.
That's right.
And part, you know,
one of the things about being kind of like the wise tribal elder is you want things that you think are of high quality. I don't want to tell everybody about all the crap I've listened to over the course of time, but for those 10, 20 gems that they really shouldn't fade away, boy, we love Todd Rundgren, Colleen and I. We've seen him in concert a dozen times. One of the cool things that he did was he doesn't just do his own music. He occasionally will say, you know, this song, the band that did it is no longer together. Nobody's playing it. It doesn't deserve to be an orphan. And then he broke into Lunatic Fringe from Red Rider.
Oh, yeah.
Fantastic song. I mean, awesome. Tom, why am I blanking on names today? The guy who was Red Rider, you know, pretty Tom Cochran. I think he still does it, but he like never made it big. Canadian artist. I think he must still do it in concert. But when I actually saw that live at U of I, when Red Rider opened for one of our bands, it was so, it's just a great energetic song, a perfect, you know, 4 minutes of crunch.
It is.
And the fact that he has that good taste to be able to say, you know, we can't just let this song fade away. That's kind of, I'm not Todd Rundgren, but I have some sense of, you know, there's bands that people haven't heard of, or there's things that one hit wonders, or just things like, it's been too long since we listened to Children of the Sun by Billy Thorpe. Let's go listen to Children of the Sun together. You know, that kind of thing.
And the cool thing is, you know, if we did something on Spotify, it wouldn't branch out everywhere, but we could put the whole song in there and we wouldn't get in trouble. Let's think about that. We should each pick like 5 songs that we think are our top favorites or missing classics or something. Do a little research on it and see what we come up with. And then we should both listen, exchange, and sit down. Let's plan that. Maybe
when
something
I've been
to do
in
right
conversations
after
about this, like at Mensa gatherings, oftentimes it'll
really
be,
no,
it's a yeah. You know, maybe that's it. You know, get through the end of this year just cruising correctly, and then we'll take on something new.
Yeah.
But then also, if you want to be like, hey, kids, you should be buying this, you know, and then it'll be a Christmas recommendation thing.
Oh,
I used to love the categories where it's like, you know, what are the songs that if you hear it in the car, you immediately crank it up? And maybe that's already crap because nobody listens to the radio. Everybody's coming out of their player. Mm-hmm. But there are certain things that I like the randomness of it. And then it's like, this is the perfect driving song, or it's the perfect anthem that you're going to sing along with every word. And so all those different categories of like, what do you put on when you're cleaning the house and it energizes you? What are you, what's your long drive road music? You know what I mean? Is there an entire album? I think that a lot of those, categories or like quirky categorizations, that'd be a cool way to approach this, is to think of.
I actually, and that's funny. I mean, we think alike so often. At one time, I was looking into getting a domain name called Cruisin' Tunes or Cartoons or something like that, and just putting on there people submitting like their favorite cruising tune. And yeah, then, of course, my brain said, wait a minute, why does it have to be this one? We could have multiple categories, your favorite workout tune, your favorite running tune, your favorite tune to listen to with dogs, like, and that, have these lists. Of course, and then I discovered Ranker, which is kind of really does what the same thing is.
Anybody, you know, building a playlist will do that, that it's not just, hey, here's a bunch of songs that I like. It's like, here's the things I do when I walk my dog or whatever right, else it might be. Right. You know?
Yeah. So, yeah, that's cool.
That'd be fun.
Okay. All right. Hey, how long have we been on since we, we've been on for a while.
Exactly.
So we had an
interruption in the middle there. Saturday, it's, we have it coming up, you know, it's, we're at 6 o'clock on Saturday night at the Halloween, and as I laughed about, the title of it this year is A Weem Away, which I think is just hilariously witty. And there's a whole bunch of programs. There's like 36 different programs happening in different virtual rooms over the course of the day. I'll be going to the one on business card origami. There's one about like celebratory drinks, you know, what has become associated with a different holiday, all kinds of stuff. I'm leaning towards, you know, every year I've done pretentious drinking in real life in the past where it's a wonderful mingling event. We have 100 different liqueurs that everybody can sample. Right. I'm really getting, not pressured, but asked, please do it. It would be a shame to not have it done. Beth and Stan are the ones that they now store pretentious drinking supplies in their house while in between, because they live near Chicago.
Are they really storing them?
You know, if there's a certain amount of shrinkage, I'll be proportionally pissed based on why is there a whole case missing?
Exactly. It's been a long pandemic.
Right, exactly. But it really might be fun to just everybody have their favorite liqueur and say, well, here's what it is and why I like it. And so it'd be easy to fill an hour with just everybody kind of chatting and sipping and not let's all get drunk together and be stupid. But I guess one of the reasons I've always liked pretentious drinking was if you're going to imbibe a little bit, at least you're not driving home. You're in a hotel with your friends. They're going to take care of you. All you have to do is be able to press the up button on the elevator to make it back to your room. It's a very safe place compared to some of the hazards of going out drinking in a bar and stuff like that. So maybe what could be even more safe than all I have to do is be able to like shut down my computer and stumble off to bed if I have had one or two or nips of various different strong stuff. But it'll be fun just to.
Or you forget to shut off your computer and we see Al walking around in his underwear his head.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. How come I have the picture of Al's face? Oh, that's where he put his head down on the keyboard and fell asleep. Exactly. Right.
All right, man.
All right.
So we'll get this spliced together and get it out. I can't wait till Saturday. Sounds all the good. Great horror stuff.
Exactly. We're gonna make a recording, whatever, however many dozen of people join us. Like I said, we'll have lots to say. I'm sure others will join. I have no idea how it's going to go, except it's going to be cool. It's going to be raucous and fun. So I'll see you there. Okay.
All right, man.
We do want to do practice in the green room that they've set up beforehand to make sure that we know we can do things on Discord, that we can record on our machine from Discord because it doesn't have its own internal recording facility, just to make sure that we're all set up. So
is there sometime later today or maybe Thursday or Friday? You want
to, let's shoot for Thursday. I think I'm going to go to the vaults today to work on comics. If we let's pick a time, I'll coordinate with Greg Holcomb, who is the wizard of doing the, getting all the presentations set up AV wise, and we'll coordinate with him. Okay.
Okay. Yeah. I'm good early in the morning and then afternoon.
Very good. I'll shoot for
I have another meeting at 11.
So I'll shoot for like 9 or 10, maybe something like that.
Perfect.
Perfect.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, let's do that.
Very good. Thanks very much, Steve.
Cool. Talk to you later, man. You're back.
You have been listening to the Relentless Geekery Podcast. Come back next week and join Alan and Steven's conversation on geek topics of the week.